Hello there, people in podcast world. This is Anne Althaus, your podcaster, your blogger. And what's going on the blog this morning? Well, everything is either about Trump and the election, more or less, or it's about Maggie Hambling, an artist that I'd never heard of before, but I take it she's rather famous in England. So where should we start? Let's start with the artist. Let's deal with the artist, because the first thing I saw this morning was a statue that I thought was bad. I went to Twitter, and this was trending on Twitter. I don't think it's supposed to be of Mary Wollstonecraft, but it is a tribute to her, and it's like this giant splash of a wave, out of the top of which comes the figure of a woman, a naked woman. It's art. It's art. We don't say naked. We say nude. Nude. Don't say naked. It's got the K sound. It's the funny word. Naked sounds ridiculous. If she's naked, she better put on some clothes. But if she's nude, she walks in dignity and honor and speaks of the ancients. It's abstracted. It's intellectual. It's godlike, isn't it? If she's nude. But what if she's not nude? What if she's naked? There are reasons to look at this and say, I don't see a nude. I see nakedness. Is it because the artist is a woman that she seems naked? Why are we? Is it just because it doesn't seem that well sculpted? Is it because she's gone to great pains to depict the pubic hair? Some ancient art, Roman, Greek statues, don't they sometimes have the hairstyle, the lower hairstyle depicted? I don't know. But you didn't think I would talk about that. Anyway, this post, first thing I saw was this morning was Maggie Hambling. I was put forward to paint the Queen Mother, but then the word came back saying I was a bit risky as a painter and a sculptor. She's an art world legend, but as our intrepid interviewer discovers, Maggie Hambling's private life is every bit as colorful as her work. That's in the Independent, and it's all the way back from 2010. And I'm reading that this morning, and I have a fairly long quote from it. I'm reading that this morning from 2010 because I looked up with Maggie Hambling in Wikipedia because Hambling, whom I'd never heard of, is trending on Twitter this morning because people are furious. This is a quote from a headline in ArtNet News. People are furious over this new statue of pioneering feminist Mary Wollstonecraft in London. The internet wishes she were a bit less nude. And I embed a tweet that shows a picture of this sculpture. The tweet is by someone named Auntie Mallory Blackman. Genuine question. Why present Mary Wollstonecraft as naked? I've seen many statues of male writers, rights, activists, and philosophers, and I can't remember any of them being bare-assed. That's because they're not bare-assed. They're nude. If you're bare-assed, you're naked. But if you're nude, you're not naked. You're not bare-assed. We don't say that. We say nude, and then you're lifted up. You're in this high intellectual level, not in this lowly, sexual, degraded, embarrassed level. It's because you're so lifted up, but it's in the eye of the beholder. So if you see this statue as bare-assed or naked, you're not looking right. Look again. Look until you see the lofty abstractedness of it. And I said, was Hambling's tribute to Oscar Wilde more respectful? He's rising out of a tomb. And really, I show you a picture of it, and it's not a very good depiction of Oscar Wilde. And Wollstonecraft is rising out of a wave. Oscar Wilde is rising out of a tomb. Hambling seems to like the human figure coming up out of something awkward. I mean, I just don't think the sculptures are very well done, quite aside from the conception. And whether it properly honors the famous person. Does Oscar Wilde look like Oscar Wilde? As for Mary Wollstonecraft, do you even have a picture of her in your head? How she looked? I didn't. Had to look it up. Got an old painting. Nice painting, I think. Not awkward. but, you know, a portrait. And I said, I'm not British. I'm not caught up in the worship of Maggie Hambling. I take it there's some kind of adulation of her that has them giving her money for things that don't seem to be very good at all. But isn't that the way of public sculpture in the last 50 years? Money is spent and eyesores are installed. But if there's nakedness, that will get the most airplay, and the people talking about it will seem like rubes and prudes. And I repeat the line from the article from 2010, She Likes Jokes. But I haven't read that to you yet, so let me go back to the top of this post and begin with the line, She Likes Jokes. Remember, this is from the 2010 article in The Independent, long before the controversy about the new Mary Wollstonecraft sculpture came up. And this is a quote. She likes jokes. She likes the one David Hockney told her once. It goes, the trouble with Van Gogh is, if you tell him something, it goes in one ear and stays there. She laughs again. Maggie, I exclaim, you are smoking again. Didn't you give up 5 years ago? She says she did, but last year, on her birthday, her large bronze sculpture of a rising wave was being erected, and it was fraught. And I thought, fuck it, it's my birthday, I'll smoke. She smokes with sensational gusto. I can't stand namby-pamby, take it or leave it smokers. I call them crap smokers, and Maggie is not a crap smoker. I think I was once put forward to paint the Queen Mother, but word came back saying I was a bit risky, so it didn't happen. Perhaps they thought you'd seduce her. She was very fond of gentlemen. She could have painted Margaret Thatcher, but didn't bother. Some big conservative association wanted her to do it, but she refused. As a sculptor, Maggie's public works include her Charing Cross memorial to Oscar Wilde. It shows him rising from a sarcophagus. Critics seem to loathe Oscar, the sculptor. Would you have liked to have been a mother, Maggie? She says, the thing of actually giving birth to this thing that's been inside you for 9 months must be quite an event. And I've always said that if ever a painting was crying out in one room and a baby was crying out in another, I'm animal enough to go to the baby. It sounds corny, but it's true. My works are my babies. Did your parents accept you being gay? My mother had a great problem with it. She hated saying the word lesbian, and I don't like it either. I prefer lesbionic or dyke. Now, what I liked about that was that thing about having a baby. My works are my babies. But if she had a real-life baby, and the baby was crying out in one room, and her paintings and sculptures were crying out in the other, she would be, quote, animal enough to go to the baby. And so that means that the baby will get her attention over and over again because she's a human being. But to be an artist, she needs to go to her work. And so she would not have gotten her work done. She would not have been the artist that she is. Whether she's actually a good artist, that's another question. But who knows? Maybe the kids would have been no damn good either. Maybe they would have been awkward. Maybe they would have been big jerks. Anyway, I see that in the comments to this post, John Mosby says, there's a nude bronze of Balzac by Rodin. And yes, you can see his Balzac. And going to the page for that tweet by Auntie Mallory Blackman, I see that response is already given. Somebody answered her and said, meet Rodin's nude Balzac. So you can see the Rodin sculpture, very famous sculpture of a portly Balzac striding forward, completely proud of himself. And he's out and proud with his genitalia, you know? So it's not really a problem. And somebody else in the comments said there is a very nice memorial to Shelley, Percy Shelley, who was the son-in-law of Mary Wollstonecraft. And it's, if you go to that, I don't have that at the blog, maybe I should do a separate post, but it's a really dramatic, romantic picture of him lying down, having drowned. Of course, he drowned. And so this is a picture of his naked, drowned body. And he was 29. He was 29 when he drowned. So you see a 29-year-old man, a slight, thin man, and his genitalia completely depicted and out there, lying flopped over to the side of the nude, sprawled, dead body. And so is that... That gets your attention. It seems very exalted. It's very down to earth and very exalted, kind of like the combination of a baby and a painting, both crying in different rooms in your house. Which way do you go? Where do you go? But if you put clothes on the person, you bring that person to earth, you make them mundane and as they are in their ordinary life as they interact with other people. Because you never do that nude, right? You're only nude when you're being drowned, when you're being made into a god like a Greek statue, but put you in your clothes and you're in your period, you're part of the society of that time. There was an alternative sculpture that was presented to the group that picked the Maggie Hambling sculpture, and that did show her in the clothes of the time. And they picked the exalted one, the exalted one. Now, I ran into another. Well, I guess I was, this was suggested to me somewhere in a sidebar, and it's a May interview with Maggie Hambling in the Times of London, and it's about the lockdown, it's about the coronavirus. So this is from May, and the quote of hers that I used for the post title is, "I decided to befriend the crisis and give it a name, Locky Lockdown." And there's one way to deal with the lockdown, give it a name, Locky Lockdown, Locky. It's like Rocky. So that was popping up on my screen because of the other post. And I said, back then she painted a self-portrait and called it Angry. Her lockdown self, this is a quote, her lockdown self-portrait about her rage at what's happened, about the way every plan that I had gone completely to pot. We're living under this dark threat. And yet, at the same time, we're aware of how good this time is. How the roads and the skies are not buggered up by cars and planes. And even as we are scared that we are going to die, we watch this lovely spring with its flowers and its leaves and its dawn chorus of birds. Life is always uncertain, but never more so than now. The uncertainty has been so concentrated, brought before our eyes in such a dramatic way. And as a control freak, of course, that at first made me furious. That's why I painted this self-portrait angry. Meanwhile, I'm still alive. And time is all that I've got. Once I got to 60, even I, who gave up arithmetic at the age of 11, had to realize that I was past the halfway mark. And I said, I like this from the article. In the 1990s, a longstanding female admirer died, and much to Hambling's surprise, bequeathed her a Suffolk College and its adjoining water meadows. And I said, did anyone not a member of your family ever die and leave you anything? I mean, even $1,000? She gets a Suffolk College and adjoining water meadows? I don't even know what water meadows are. Maybe it's a pain in the ass to be stuck with the responsibility of a water meadow. What is it, a swamp? No, here's Wikipedia. Water meadows were mainly used in Europe from the 16th to the early 20th centuries. They were used for fields on slopes, and relatively little engineering skill was required to construct them. So these are man-made things, water meadows. Unlike swamps, they're something that you make. You have a sloping field, and here's what you do, quote, water from a stream or spring was fed to the top of a sloping field, and gentle sloping terraces were formed along which the water could trickle in a zigzag fashion down the field. Former water meadows are found along many river valleys, where the sluice gates, channels, and field ridges may still be visible. The drains in a derelict water meadow are generally clogged and wet, and most of the carrier channels are dry, with the smaller ones on ridgetops often invisible. The complex mixture of wet and drier ground often gives derelict water meadows, particularly high wetland biodiversity. Anyway, yeah, maybe someday an admirer of mine will surprise me by leaving me some piece of real estate. I hope it's on some god-awful swamp, however. There must be movies about people who are left some piece of real estate, and then it seems like it's going to be good, but one thing after another. Sounds like a good beginning for a horror movie. But anyway, the water meadows are actually very interesting. I like the idea that you're taking advantage of the sloping quality of your land and that the water trickles in a zigzag fashion. I don't know, that seems pretty to me, that you have used the shape of the land and you've created something man-made, and there is a zigzag to it. Maybe this is a little bit like the way terracing for rice paddies is done, that you start with a hill, and then you get the water at the top of the hill, and then you get something going by virtue of this flow of the water. So you're getting the water to flow the right way, and now you can farm it and irrigate it. Sounds very nice. Sounds very nice. Could fit into our old homesteading theme, perhaps. All right, now we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 left. And they're all more or less related to the election. I don't know what order you want to do them, but I'm going to put the Benford's Law one first, partly because I wrote it first, and partly because let's get the math done first. How do you do your homework? You do the math first. Get the math done. Do it. Get it out of the way. Put it over to the side. Got that done. It's done. You know it's right. And then futz around with the rest of the things that you can either go long or short on. But the math, you can just do it. Right, just do the math. Quote, this is my post. To say, quote, deviation from Benford's law does not prove election law took place, close quote. To say that is not to say that it isn't relevant evidence. So this is from Reuters. Reuters does a fact check that begins by stating the proposition in an ultra strong way. Quote, social media users have been sharing posts that say a mathematical rule called Benford's Law provides clear proof of fraud in the United States presidential election. And I said, here's how the proposition to be fact-checked could have been stated. Benford's Law is of some use in determining whether or not there was fraud or error in the U.S. presidential election. See how if you state the proposition differently, you might get a different answer when you fact-check it. The way Reuters stated it in such a strong way that this one thing, standing alone, provides clear proof of fraud, then it's much easier to say, no, it doesn't. Fact-check, false. Well, it's false because you've stated it in the way that's easiest to show is false, and that puts me on guard and makes me skeptical that Reuters isn't going to do the fact check right. Because first of all, why say fraud as opposed to fraud or error? You know, you say fraud and then it seems like you need the human element of intent to do it wrong. It seems to be involved as opposed to just people were sloppy or negligent or something was lost. Also by saying clear proof of fraud as opposed to some evidence of fraud that might ultimately prove fraud when put into a pile with all the other evidence. And then just to say the idea of so clear proof and the idea of just using that one thing, it seems to be a tool for looking at evidence. So what we have so far may be just a red flag about where there could be a problem, then we need to look more closely into it. It would be harder to say that that's false. So I've restated the proposition the way I think if Reuters was going to be fair or signal to us that they're going to be fair and balanced, they would have stated the proposition more like Benford's Law is of some use in determining whether or not there was fraud or error in the U.S. presidential election. And if you're a lawyer, you should recognize that as corresponding to Rule 401 in the Federal Rules of Evidence. It's a test for whether evidence is relevant. So evidence needs to be relevant before it's admissible. So we're not talking about whether the evidence is conclusive proof of anything, but just whether it has any value in getting us closer to the, do we get one step closer to understanding that something is true or false, something that matters, something that is an issue. Back to the post. Reuters is asking whether this evidence, standing alone, will meet a burden of proof, which is a tricky shortcut through fact-checking. In real life, we don't depend on one piece of evidence. We look at whatever might be useful as we make decisions about how much more to investigate. Does Benford's law raise suspicions that would make a fair-minded person want to look more closely and to gather more evidence? But we don't really have fair-minded people. We have highly partisan people on one side who are eager to cast doubt on the election, and on the other side who want to say, stop right now, don't do anything, it's all in, it's all over, give up. So these people aren't going to be fair-minded. Reuters, and I'm the closest thing you're going to get to a fair-minded person, so Reuters strikes me as falling into the second group, the people who want to say, stop right now. And the reason I'm detecting them as members of that group is because of the way they stated the proposition that they were going to fact check. They showed their hand. I could see what side they were on. And it's so dumb. It's so dumb to reveal that. At least know enough about what you're doing so that you can hide the signs that you're biased. At least pretend, at least fake it. But, you know, thanks for showing me that you're biased, because then I can discount everything that you say. And yet, this is the best article on Benford's Law that I was able to find. I did look because I heard people in social media talking about it, and I wanted to get a little up to speed, you know, without being pushed around that, oh, Benford's Law, it's all explained by Benford's Law. You know, it's math. Now, let's look at the experts consulted. So now I'm looking into this Reuters article. And I'm not going to explain what Benford's Law is. You can read the article or find your own article and see what kinds of things people are saying about how Benford's Law works. Quote, Theodore P. Hill, professor emeritus of mathematics at Georgia Tech, Atlanta, cautioned that regardless of the distribution uncovered, the application of Benford's Law would not provide definitive evidence that fraud took place. See, this is what I've been saying. Okay, yeah, duh, we know this. It's not definitive evidence that fraud took place. First, I'd like to stress that Benford's Law cannot be used to prove fraud, he told Reuters by mail. It is only a red flag test that can raise doubts, e.g., the IRS has been using it for decades to ferret out fraudsters, but only by identifying suspicious entries, at which time they put auditors to work on the hard evidence. See, that's basically what I've been saying. Quote, Dr. Jen Goldbeck, professor of the College of Information Studies at the University of Maryland, told Reuters, there is just not solid evidence that Benford works in elections at all. The results are profoundly mixed, which means it's not evidence of anything. And I said, that addresses my question. She asserts that it's not even relevant evidence, not evidence of anything. And why would that be? Quote, Goldbeck points out that the numbers on some graphs being cited by social media users are not even labeled, whilst the law works on very specific types of numbers. She added that none of the research that analyzes the Benford Law is as simplistic as the analysis people are posting. Instead, research uses quite advanced statistical techniques, often looking at the second digits, which have their own expected distribution, close quote. And I said, that's different from saying it doesn't work in elections at all. But she didn't say that. She only said there's no solid evidence that it works in elections. Obviously, she's responding to claims made in social media that overstate the usefulness and meaning of applying Benford's Law in this case. But the point is that you'd need to do much more to make even a modest claim about the usefulness of Benford's Law. And I'm not surprised that the experts aren't eager to do this work for Trump supporters who have gone too far in making their claims. The specific, and then here's another quote from the article, the specific case of the Milwaukee results was also examined by Professor Bud Rukima of Poland's Nicholas Copernicus University. Rukima considered the application of Benford's law to the 2009 Iranian elections. He told Reuters by email, "A major flaw in applying Benford's law to the Milwaukee results is that the logarithmic distribution, how many powers of 10 there are in the numbers of votes per ward in Milwaukee, is very narrow. In other words, half of all the wards have total votes from about 570 to 1,200, and the logarithmic average is about 800. Biden overall got about 70% of the votes in Milwaukee, so the most likely vote for Biden in the simplest model, assuming no falsification, in a typical Milwaukee ward is something like 0.7 times 800, which is 560 votes. We expect about half the Biden votes to lie between about 400 and 850 in a typical Milwaukee ward. So the most popular first digit of the votes for Biden should be 5, the first digit of 560, and 4s and 6s and 7s should also be reasonably frequent. This is just what we see in the blue vertical bars in the top left figure in the diagram. So Benford's law reasoning applied to the real data shows no reason to suspect fraud here. And I said, aha, that's the most useful analysis. Rukima is asking whether there is some evidence, whether a red flag is raised, justifying looking more deeply. He's saying no. Let's talk about it from there. Okay, that's the math. It's something I said in the comments I wanted to bring out. I said the trick is to make people want to think what you want them to think. And saying I've got complicated math here might be a good way to make people want to agree with you rather than understand the math. Or it may make people want to get the hell away from you. Math is an interesting public opinion weapon, but it cuts both ways. It will make people defer to you or make people run away from you. It's probably a wash, or as we say in math, same difference. So you make a math argument, people are like, that sounds pretty impressive. If they want the thing that you're saying to be true, other people might say, I want nothing to do with you because I would have to understand math in order to hear what you're saying. And one or the other probably depends on whether you're already for Trump or against Trump. Now, some people will actually do the math and are interested in it and are the experts, and they'll actually get enough data to use the math properly and they'll understand the difference. But I don't think there's enough of that going on, and I don't think the Trump people who are talking about Benford's law are showing anything significant other than bamboozling the people who would love some experts to come to their assistance and help the thing they want to be true. Because, that's what people do. They tend to believe what they want to believe. And I said in another comment, the question is whether this evidence is admissible. But for political, and then what is the standard of proof? Can this evidence go into the pile of all of the evidence? And then when we assess the evidence, what standard of proof do we use? But that has to do with law and going to trial. And for political argument, there are no standards what you can use. People can believe what they want to believe. They can consult the voices they hear in their head. They can choose the opinion that makes them seem like a nicer person. So social reasons, emotional reasons for picking the arguments they like, and they're the standards of whether this is good evidence or whether the math adds up is something that the great majority of people are not doing at all. They're just looking for what they like. And isn't that what the internet is about? What do you like? Do you like this podcast? Am I trying to be likable? If I want to have a popular podcast, you should like me, please. Like me so much that when you die, you leave me a water meadow, a swamp. Just leave me your swamp. Leave me your problems. Drain the swamp. No one says that anymore. I see David Ignatius has a piece in the Washington Post that says President Trump's senior military and intelligence officials have been warning him strongly against declassifying information about Russia that his advisors say would compromise sensitive collection methods and anger key allies. Trump and his allies and his allies want the information public because they believe it would rebut claims that Russian President Vladimir Putin supported Trump in 2016. That may sound like ancient history, but for Trump, ancient history. It makes me think of the Hillary remark about Benghazi when she testified about what difference does it make now? Or what, right? If that's in the past, get over the past. Don't look at the past. Just yesterday, we were reading about the compliments to Biden because he consulted with historians, and Trump doesn't care about the past. What is the importance of the past? That's ancient history now. Well, it wasn't ancient history throughout the entire Trump presidency, but once he's gone, we don't need to be looking for present uses of past information. Who cares about the past unless it's useful for attacking your enemies, for getting things done that you want to get done? If Trump is already out, well, don't do, let's just forget about all the things that might have been useful to get him out. He's out, he will be out, and everything else is ancient history. Back to the article. CIA Director Gina Haspel last month argued strongly at a White House meeting against disclosing the information. Haspel also met personally with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell Tuesday. Haspel's most unlikely defender has been Attorney General William P. Barr, who opposed a pre-election push to declassify the sensitive material, according to three current and former officials, at a showdown meeting at the White House. Barr pushed back against revealing the secret information. The issue may have played a role in Trump's surprise decision on Monday to fire Defense Secretary Mark T. Esper. Okay, so that's David Ignatius, whose name I most remember as being the guy who had the information about the Bill Clinton scandal involving Monica Lewinsky and decided to not reveal that, covered that up, and that's how we ended up with Drudge. Right? Because Drudge put that stuff up when Ignatius had decided to bury it. Well, there are lots of reasons to bury stories. Bury. Do you pronounce Barry, B-U-R-Y, different from Barry, B-A-R-R-Y? Barry. Or do you say them the same? Barry. And then there's the fruit, B-E-R-R-Y. Do you pronounce those three words differently? Barry. It's like Mary. Mary. Do you pronounce those words differently? I was watching an old YouTube of some professor belaboring the regional differences in pronunciation, but the reason I got stuck on that little pronunciation point is that burying the evidence, maybe they're burying the evidence because it would bring out things about the beloved president, Barack Obama, Barry Obama, Barry. Is that what's sensitive? That it would show that Obama was involved in the decision to do surveillance on his political opponent's campaign before the election, after the election in 2016? Hey, I want to know. And Trump on his way out, that's he can declassify everything. He can let us see that. But if he goes without showing it to us, he gives up that power. And now, how will we ever know? Well, I don't know what's really in there, so I can't really give the judgment. But I wonder if they're trying to protect Obama. It would be very, very sad to find out that Obama wasn't the charming, lovable figure that so many of us think he is. Meanwhile, Trump is the unlikable, horrible figure that so many people think. The beloved president, the hated president, the beautiful president, the ugly president. Why wouldn't the ugly president? It's like something in a fairy tale, like Rumpelstiltskin. Why wouldn't the ugly character, Trump, decide, you know, I'm just going to flip the switch. I'm going to show this stuff. And this beautiful prince that is so beloved, he'll be ugly. He'll be ugly in the broad light of day. It could happen. I've got an article from Axios. As the weakness of President Trump's legal cases to overturn Joe Biden's win become clearer, Republicans are talking more about the Electoral College, hinting at an extreme, last-chance way for Trump to cling to power. In this long-shot scenario, Trump and his team could try to block secretaries of state in contested states from certifying results. That could allow legislatures in those states to try to appoint new electors who favor Trump over Biden. Trump has not directly said he would pursue this strategy. Has not directly said. I don't think he's indirectly said it either. Trump has not directly said that he would pursue this strategy, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo each noted on Tuesday that the election results don't become official until electors cast their votes next month. So this is me now. They're trying to insinuate that this complicated way to get Trump to a win, which would be to keep the voting results from being certified, which would then create an opening for the state legislatures to just vote on their own to appoint the electors, because the vote failed. That's the backup. You might remember that there was something of that that went on in the 2000 election in Florida. There was the idea that if all else failed, the legislatures could just appoint pro-Trump, pro-Bush people, and then they would vote. So that is the backup plan if the vote can't be certified, if there can't be a vote. But why would what McConnell and Pompeo said be any kind of evidence that they were that the Trump people were thinking of doing that? All they said was the election results don't become official until electors cast their votes next month. To me, it seems like the reason to say that would be, you know, this is the Occam's razor. What's the simplest explanation for that? Are we seeing horses or zebras? The horses answer, Occam's razor, is that they're saying the results don't become official until next month, because what they're trying to say is Trump doesn't need to concede. What Trump is doing is perfectly normal. Keep your pants on about all of this. It's quite simple. The votes are still being counted. The election, the fact that the media has called the election for Biden isn't anything official. What's official is when the secretaries of state in all of the various states certify the results. It's the certification stage. And then it's the actual voting by the electors after the certification takes place. So we can hang back and wait. That's what we're doing. It's not that we're going for this other route. And it's very hard to imagine such a thing happening. But the Biden side needs to be prepared as long as Trump keeps the uncertainty alive, tormenting them. Axios has quotes from one lawyer familiar with the process. The process. He's familiar with the process, not the Trump insiders who are planning to do anything like this, just the existence of this strange, mind-bending path to victory. This lawyer observes that Trump may be trying to scare the living bejesus out of everyone. Well, that's a good guess. What is the argument that Trump ought to be doing what he can to calm us? I hear Biden and his people telling us they want to bring calm to the country, but they're declining the opportunity to just be calm themselves until the state officials certify the results of the election. Personally, I feel calm waiting for that. Why isn't that okay? It seems to me that as long as they choose to pressure Trump to concede before the vote certification, they're forfeiting the high ground of putting calmness above everything else. So I'm not going to worry about Trump's pot stirring. Basically, calmness isn't the highest value because they're creating anxiety, worrying about this strange alternate path to Electoral College victory. They're making a big deal about Trump won't say the right thing. Say it, Trump. He needs to concede now because the media have called the election. Why create all that anxiety? Why not just be completely cool and say The certification follows a certain timeline, and December 8th is the safe harbor under the federal statute, and the states are expected to get their certification in by then, and then the Electoral College subsequently meets, and then we'll see the numbers. And all happens quite in a quite orderly fashion. Why all of this anxiety about making Trump say something instead of fighting? Well, I can see why Trump, who suffered from their keeping uncertainty about his election going throughout his entire presidency, that he's doing what he can to make their life unpleasant. Is that unpleasant for us? Might be a little unpleasant for us, but for half the country, the idea that, oh, Biden was elected, oh, good, here's Biden, the one who's going to heal us and put us to sleep so we can all be calm. Calm down, people. Calm down. Stop fighting. Resistance is futile. That just makes some people more anxious. So I'm going to just do my own part to be calm. I think we can wait for the certification process and leave Trump alone. Don't needle him or he'll needle you back. You know, when you push Trump, when you fight with Trump, he fights back. If you want him to not be so belligerent, don't fight him. Why don't you stand down? Oh, we can't stand down. We want him to stand down. Ah, I'm sick of all of you. I got one more post, and it's the one that goes back to yesterday's post, because you might remember in yesterday's post, I said something that I actually took the trouble to transcribe. I transcribed myself. and it was, this is about when I came up with I made a reference to the Henry Fonda's big speech at the end of the movie The Grapes of Wrath, where he says, a fellow ain't got a soul of his own, just a piece of a big soul, the one big soul that belongs to everyone. That's the bit from The Grapes of Wrath that I wasn't able to recite off the top of my head as I was recording my podcast yesterday, and got to the item about the historian John Meacham, who'd helped write Joe Biden's victory speech. Meacham has a book titled The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels, and Biden's speech expressed a desire to rebuild the soul of America. So you can go back to my old podcast from yesterday, and at 21 minutes and 40 seconds, I begin speaking extemporaneously. And here's what I say. This is me having said something yesterday and having transcribed it today. I am now going to read my transcription of myself. Is that involuted enough for you? Okay, here goes. I want to get into this idea of... sorry. Well, I thought something was going on in my podcasting recording. Okay, now let's focus. Focus, Altus, focus. Okay, this is me reading a transcription of myself, okay? Here's what I said yesterday. I want to get into this idea of the soul of America. What do you think of the idea that a country has a soul? I like to think of the idea that individual human beings have a soul. And when I hear of this composite soul of the entire country, I'm skeptical. That's what makes me think of fascism, especially if you're not acknowledging the soul of individual people. And so often, from the Democratic side, I get the sense that they view their opponents as being soulless. And I feel that they're also antagonistic to individualism. Everyone needs to think the same thing, and people should be canceled if they don't all say the same thing. I read that as a rejection of the sense that individual people have a soul. And then you come at this with the idea that America has a soul. There's just an oversoul to America. And I know you can go very deeply into that. It reminds me of that speech in The Grapes of Wrath. And I know they're doing some, and I know there's some Ralph Waldo Emerson stuff you could put there. But I'm not writing a post. I'm doing a podcast. So I can't get into the research and come up with stuff. But if I were reading and writing right now and not talking, and this is the advantage of reading and writing, I would research those things and I want to add a few things. But why don't you go do it? You go read that. But I wanted, even though, did any of you Did anyone do your own research and go find the Grapes of Wrath speech and go find the Ralph Waldo Emerson essay? It's called The Oversoul. It wouldn't have been hard to find. So did you find good old Henry Fonda?
It's like Casey said, if you ain't got a soul of his own, just a little piece of a big soul. The one big soul that belongs to everybody. Then
what, Doc?
Then it don't matter. I'll be all around in the dark. I'll be everywhere. Wherever you can look. Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy.
I won't play the whole thing, but cop beating up a guy, that hit home for today's concerns, didn't it? Anyway, that's Grapes of Wrath, the end of Grapes of Wrath, where Henry Fonda, I can't remember exactly what's happening to him. Maybe he's going to die, but he sees himself as maybe his individual self isn't really anything at all. Maybe a fellow ain't got a soul of his own, just a little piece of a big soul, the one big soul that belongs to everyone. And then we've got... And now here's the Ralph Waldo Emerson essay. I'm just going to read a little part of it when he brings out this word of his, oversoul. Quote, and this will be pretty hard to understand. I think it's written in a style that's difficult to absorb in our day. I think it was a style of writing that was appreciated more in the 19th century, but I'm going to try to read it as well as I can to make it as comprehensible as possible. So I'm not going to do anything more after this is over. So if you don't want to have the 19th century inflicted on you, you can stop now. You won't miss anything except this. Maybe it's a beautiful passage. I'm going to try to read it as well as possible. So here goes. When I watched that flowing river, which out of regions I see not, pours for a season its streams into me, I see that I am a pensioner, not a cause, but a surprised spectator of this ethereal water. And I desire and look up and put myself in the attitude of reception, but from some alien energy the visions come. The supreme critic on the errors of the past and the present, and the only prophet of that which must be, is that great nature in which we rest, as the earth lies in the soft arms of the atmosphere, that unity, that oversoul, within which every man's particular being is contained and made one with all other, that common heart of which all sincere conversation is the worship, to which all right action is submission. That overpowering reality which confutes our tricks and talents and constrains everyone to pass for what he is and to speak from his character and not from his tongue, and which evermore tends to pass into our thought and hand and becomes wisdom and virtue and power and beauty. We live in succession, in division, in parts, in particles. Meantime, within man is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one. And that's the end of the quote. I just wanted to say one thing. I did promise the people who already turned off that I was going to end, but I didn't say I wouldn't comment at all, but I want to comment one thing. I want to say that he speaks of water here, and I think that there was a lot of water in this podcast. He talked about a flowing river, like all of nature is like a flowing river, and it pours for a season into you. It pours for a season its streams into me. So there's this flowing river, and it pours and streams through you as if you were a water meadow. And maybe you're Percy Shelley. drowning at age 29 and lying as a marble figure naked on your catafalque. But so there's this idea that all of nature is like a flowing river, and it pours for a season, it streams into you. And then there is the idea that, where did I see water again? The supreme, I see that I'm a pensioner, not a cause, but a surprised spectator of this ethereal water. So ethereal water, there's this great divine nature that he pictures as water, water that flows into you. And maybe it's you, and maybe you're a spectator of it, that I desire and look up. I put myself in the attitude of reception. So just let that water flow into you, flow through you, within you and without you, as the Beatles say. And so there is this, earth lies in the soft arms of the atmosphere. So we have the water, earth, air, fire, and water. We have the earth and the atmosphere. So we've got the air and the earth and the water. You know, it's all about nature. I guess you have to sort of absorb all of that. Don't be a sponge absorbing like that. You need the water to flow through you, not get stuck in you. You're not supposed to be a special dam that contains more water than anybody else. Just be part of that river. Have that river flowing through you. That oversoul within which every man's particular being is contained. So you're part of the oversoul. Just like a fellow ain't got a soul of his own, just a little piece of a big soul. And one big soul that belongs to everyone. I think there's more individualism in Emerson's idea. He does have every man as a particular being, also part of the big flowing river. But you're still a separate person, I think, for Emerson. Every man's particular being is contained and made one with all others. And I liked the common heart of which all sincere conversation is the worship. Hard to think of that today when we're in these squabbles and these arguments and our verbal interchange has grown so ugly. We could say that by Emerson's standard, this isn't sincere conversation. This isn't real conversation. So for there to be sincere conversation, we must be worshiping. It must be a ritual of worship of the common heart. Can you imagine that? When you're talking, when you're having a conversation, that you're engaged in a ritual of worship of what we all have in common. You know, it's not that different from something that John Meacham said that we were looking at yesterday. Do you remember that? Oh, what was that? Now I'm in one of those positions where there's something I want to read. Now, don't tell me I'm going to be back here on the blog tomorrow trying to transcribe what I'm saying now and looking for the one thing that I couldn't remember while trying to talk fluidly. You ever notice that speech is like a river? It has to keep flowing. It has to flow. We speak of writing flowing, but the person who's doing the writing may experience some flow, may have a flowing set of thoughts. But really, when you write, you can pause and stop and rewrite and do research and all of these other things. It's not really flowing like a river. It's only in the speech that you have to flow like a river. Now, the truth is, I can hit a button over here and stop it and start again in another segment, and you probably wouldn't even notice that I'd done that. So I really could be stopping and doing research all the time. But I haven't been doing that yet. I think I've done that occasionally. But I'm not going to do it now. It's a lovely day here in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 11:27 here in Madison, Wisconsin. I went out for my morning run today by my favorite body of water, Lake Mendota. Just one of our lakes. Beautiful lake. We have other beautiful lakes here in Madison. Nature flows in Madison, and life goes on, and the common heart is shared, except when we're being so ugly to each other. But, you know, nature isn't always beautiful and pretty and flowing. There's some ugly things, too. just have to roll with that. The coronavirus is part of nature. It's part of nature. Does that flow through you? Or do you resist? You can resist. Be yourself. Your individuality and your life is important in its particularity. You don't have to just calm yourself down and be part of the big whole. W-H-O-L-E. And there's also the whole W-H-O-L-E. I did speak of burial in this podcast.